worldwide news update. Gaza authorities said an Israeli airstrike killed five Palestinian journalists outside a hospital on Thursday, but the Israeli army said it had attacked a vehicle carrying Islamic Jihad militants. The journalists died after their vehicle was struck in the vicinity of Al-Adwa Hospital in Nuzrat, the enclave's health authority said. They worked for the Al-Quds Today channel. The mother of one of the killed journalists, who attended the funeral, condemned the attack that killed her son, Fadi Hassouna. Give us peace. They took our loved ones. They took my only son. There were two. One is gone. One is gone. One is gone. May God protect you. It's over. There's no sweetness left. No sweetness left. Palestinian media and local reporters said the vehicle was marked as a media van and was used by journalists to report from inside the hospital in Nuzrat camp. The incident happened a day after Palestinian militant group Hamas and Israel traded blame over their failure to reach a ceasefire agreement, despite progress reported by both sides in recent days. Residents of Syria's capital city called for unity on Thursday after unrest in the cities of Tartus and Homs and an attack on police officers which left 14 dead and injured. The officers were killed in an ambush by forces loyal to the ousted government in the Tartus countryside, the transitional administration said, as demonstrations and an overnight curfew elsewhere marked the most widespread unrest since Bashar al-Assad's removal more than 2 weeks ago. It's something Damascus residents like Issam Rahal don't want to happen again. There is no need for the events that happened in Tartus, and they must hit those who went out with an iron fist because we were under the control of a bad regime. Syrian police also imposed an overnight curfew in Homs, state media reported, after unrest there linked demonstrations that residents said were led by members of the minority Alawite, a sect loyal to Assad and Shiite Muslim religious communities. This is VOA News. South Korea's main opposition party introduced a bill to impeach acting President Han Duck-soo on Thursday, a day before it plans to seek a vote on the move, which could deepen a constitutional crisis triggered by a short-lived martial law declared by President Yoon Suk-yeol. The ruling People Powers Party acting chair Kwon Sung-dong cried foul. The Democratic Party's deluge and tsunami of impeachments has now gone beyond paralyzing the government to completely devastating state affairs. What the Democratic Party seeks to impeach today is not the acting President Han Duck-soo, but the government itself, the livelihoods of the public, diplomacy in South Korea. The impeachment motion, which must be voted on within 24 to 72 hours, cited a range of actions by Han as grounds for his impeachment, including his veto of a special prosecutor bill to investigate alleged wrongdoings by the First Lady and his failure to immediately appoint three justices to fill the vacancies at the Constitutional Court. If Han is impeached, the finance minister will assume the acting presidency. Azerbaijan is observing a nationwide day of mourning for the victims of the air crash that killed 38 people and left all 29 survivors injured, as speculation mounted about a possible cause of the crash, which remained unknown. VOA's Tommy McNeil reports.
Azerbaijan Airlines Embraer 190 was en route from Azerbaijan's capital to the Russian city of Grozny on Wednesday when it was diverted for reasons yet unclear and crashed while making an attempt to land in Kazakhstan. The plane went down about 3 kilometers or 2 miles from Aktau after crossing the Caspian Sea. Cell phone footage circulating online appeared to show the aircraft making a steep descent before smashing into the ground. Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Japan Airlines said on Thursday it was hit by a cyber attack that may affect both domestic and international flights. Sai Kerjasny from Reuters reports.
The company says the apparent attack began at 7:24 a.m. and disrupted the company's internal and external systems. The company said it turned off a router that was causing problems and suspended ticket sales for Thursday flights. ANA, Japan's other big airline, said it found no signs of an attack on its systems. Earlier this week, American Airlines grounded flights for an hour on Christmas Eve due to a network issue affecting thousands.
Saya Kerjasny for Reuters. Finnish police said Thursday that they are investigating whether a foreign ship was involved in the damage of an undersea power cable connecting Finland and Estonia following a sudden outage on Wednesday. Both the Finnish and Estonian government will hold extraordinary meetings later on Thursday to assess the situation, they said in separate statements. Investigators were probing the potential role of a foreign ship, police said, without naming the vessel. Operator Fingrid said in a statement that the outage could cause power supply issues during winter. That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website. I'm Christina Menenti, VOA News.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News tonight.
South Africa calls on all parties to commit to an urgent dialogue that will heal the country and set it on a new political and developmental trajectory. Furthermore, South Africa is ready to assist Mozambique in any manner to facilitate this dialogue.
That's Roland Lomola, South Africa's Minister of International Relations and Cooperation, offering help for Mozambique in dealing with post-election violence. Details coming up. Also, a prison riot left 33 people dead and 15 injured as civil unrest linked to Mozambique's disputed election continues. And today is the 20th anniversary of an Indian Ocean tsunami that killed over 300,000 people in East Africa. These stories and more on Africa News tonight. But first, our top story. Zimbabwe's President Emmerson Mnangagwa, who is chairing the Southern Africa Development Community, has said the regional bloc is ready to assist Mozambique as it grapples with post-election violence. Human rights organizations say the violence has claimed the lives of more than 100 protesters. Columbus Mavunga in Harare files this report as South Africa calls for dialogue in the former Portuguese colony, where the opposition is claiming its electoral victory was stolen in the October 9th polls.
In a statement, Zimbabwe's President Emmerson Mnangagwa, current chairman of the 16-nation Southern African Development Community, SADC, said the post-election violence in Mozambique must end after the country's Constitutional Council this week gave 65% victory of the October election to the ruling Frelimo Party. Ronald Lomola, South Africa's Minister of International Relations and Cooperation, released an audio message on social media weighing in on post-election violence in Mozambique.
South Africa calls on all parties to commit to an urgent dialogue that will heal the country and set it on a new political and developmental trajectory. Furthermore, South Africa is ready to assist Mozambique in any manner to facilitate this dialogue.
So did Venancio Mondlane, Mozambique's run-up to the Frelimo's Daniel Francisco Chapo in the disputed October presidential election. He said, "We are not focused on our brother who is suffering, who has been massacred by Frelimo. That's not our focus. If you want change in the country, a revolution, my brothers, let's defend the shops of our neighbors, companies of our neighbors, let's defend them." Kanye Farise, Amnesty International Deputy Regional Director for East and Southern Africa, urged the Mozambique government to end what she called one of the worst crackdowns on protesters.
Since the outcome of the elections on 9 October, police have responded with excessive use of force against those who decide to express themselves and to exercise their right to freedom of association and assembly. We've seen police using live ammunition, using rubber bullets, and using various forms of excessive force against protesters. Many people have been seriously wounded, and over 110 people have been killed.
Borges Namir, a researcher with the Institute for Security Studies, says peace is important so the country's closed ports can open to service countries like Zimbabwe, Zambia, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Malawi, and South Africa.
So nothing is happening. Everything has been paralyzed in Mozambique. It means that people will face more hardship even after this is over. The fastest way to solve this problem is dialogue. There is no alternative to dialogue.
With the opposition and regional organizations such as SADC and African Union now calling for peace in Mozambique, there is hope that the situation can change. Columbus Mavunga, VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
And in more news from Mozambique, a prison riot in Mozambique's capital Maputo left 33 people dead and 15 injured. The country's police general commander, Bernardino Rafael, said Wednesday as civil unrest linked to October's disputed election continues. A decision on Monday by Mozambique's top court confirming long-ruling party Frelimo's victory in the election has sparked fresh nationwide protests by opposing groups and their supporters who say the vote was rigged. About 1,534 people escaped from the prison in the incident, but 150 have been recaptured, Rafael said, adding that there were prison break attempts at two other prisons as well. Two decades ago, a devastating tsunami hit Eastern African nation along the Indian Ocean, killing over 300 people and displacing thousands across Kenya, Somalia, and Tanzania. As the region commemorates the catastrophic event, experts say improved early warning systems and disaster preparedness that can help prevent such losses in the future are still inadequate. Juma Majanga reports from Nairobi.
Mwalola wa Mwalola, a longtime fisherman in the Indian Ocean on the Kenyan coast, vividly remembers the events of the deadly tsunami that hit the ocean 20 years ago. Mwalola says the fisherfolk's experience and knowledge of the ocean saved his life after they sensed danger and decided to keep off the ocean on the fateful day. He says his place of work was hit, but he was not affected because he heeded to the warning. He goes on to say that they avoided losses because they warned their colleagues of the impending danger and asked everyone to keep off the ocean that day. On December 26, 2004, a powerful earthquake off the coast of the Indonesian island of Sumatra generated a devastating tsunami that was observed worldwide and caused tremendous devastation and deaths throughout the Indian Ocean region, including in East Africa. Out of the 228,000 people killed, more than 300 were from the East African countries of Somalia, Tanzania, and Kenya, according to the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, or UNESCO. The disaster raised awareness about the threat posed by tsunamis to coastal communities around the world and the need for improved tsunami detection, forecasting, warning, and preparedness. Observers say more remains to be done in the East African countries that were affected. Shamim Wasinyanda is an environmental activist at the Tanzania Ocean Climate Innovation Hub in Dar es Salaam.
There's that increasing of vulnerabilities due to climate change, but also looking at that limited adaptation funding, which most of the coastal cities lack sufficient financial resources to implement these climate adaptation measures, particularly in urban, under-resourced communities. They do not have that kind of technology or resources for them to be able to work on these problems that we're experiencing, especially as much as tsunamis are concerned.
Nyanda says increasing urbanization is compounding the risk.
Coastal cities like Dar es Salaam itself have continued to expand with informal settlements, encroaching on vulnerable areas where many residents like disaster-proof housing and infrastructure, it's not available. And so people just find themselves constructing or building houses in areas that they are not supposed to do so. And so when these disasters come, like the tsunami, they are not prepared. They do not have the technology. They do not have the infrastructure. And what happens? They're just swept away.
As countries commemorate the 20th anniversary of the 2004 tsunami, experts say preparedness, prevention, and mitigation measures are key in preventing such disasters in future. Juma Majanga, VOA News, Nairobi.
You're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Find us on voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs, and a whole lot more. I'm your host, Yehia Suhib, in Washington. A migrants' rights group says at least 10,457 migrants, an average of 30 a day, have died or disappeared while trying to reach Spain by sea in 2024, up 58% from last year, and the most since the group began keeping a tally in 2007. In a report covering the year through December 5th, Caminando Fronteras, or Walking Borders, blamed the use of flimsy boats and increasingly dangerous routes, as well as lack of resources for rescues, for the surge in deaths. The victims were from 28 nations, mostly in Africa, but also from Iraq and Pakistan. The vast majority of the fatalities, 9,757, took place on the Atlantic migration route from Africa to Spain's Canary Islands, which has received a record number of migrants for the second year in a row. The regional government of the Canaries says it is overwhelmed, and in October, thousands of people took part in rallies in main cities in the archipelago to demand action to curb the surge in arrivals. During his Christmas Eve broadcast, Spain's King Felipe VI warned that without proper management of migration, it can lead to tensions that erode social cohesion. Spain, Italy, and Greece are the major European gateways for migrant arrivals. Bioeconomy is the production, use, and conservation of biological resources to produce goods that sustain communities. A news report says the promotion of bioeconomy as a way to deal with climate change holds promise for rural areas in Africa and elsewhere. Mohamed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
As the world grapples with how to cope with the effects of climate change on the environment, food production and people's livelihoods, experts say the bioeconomy can offer solutions to those challenges and help achieve sustainable development. Their conclusions are presented in a new report, The State of the Bioeconomy in East Africa Report 2024, authored by the Stockholm Environment Institute, the East African Science and Technology Commission, and the International Centre of Insects, Physiology and Ecology, or ICIPE. The authors say the use of renewable biological resources and the application of related knowledge, science and technology offers a chance to drive economic growth and, most importantly, boost food security while protecting the environment. For example, Regina Mudama is a farmer who trains other farmers in her community in eastern Kenya, where there is often a shortage of rain to grow food. She says she plants several types of crops and trees together to maximize the water supply and so the trees can shade crops from the strong African sun.
We are growing trees which are integrate with the crops so that when we are watering the other trees, we can also water the crops that can give us food. The kinds of trees we plant can mitigate climate change, can also prevent soil erosion, can also give us good oxygen.
Experts say Eastern Africa is home to vast agricultural fertile lands, biodiversity and a youthful population, which positions the region as a leader in bioeconomy innovation. Abdu Tenkuano is a Director General of ICIPE Kenya. Speaking at the Global Biodiversity Summit, GBS, this week in Nairobi, he said bioeconomy development needs to provide opportunities for the young people and develop ways to meet people's food needs.
We must also meet the employment needs of the youth, who are the largest demographic segment in Africa and the global south. With the climate crisis, which is now an existential threat, we must adopt new ways of production and consumption that are sustainable. The bioeconomy offers this new model of sustainable economic growth.
According to the Stockholm Environment Institute, more than 65% of people living in Eastern Africa depend on biological resources for food, energy, medicine, and other purposes. Venta Mwengera is a chairperson of national and international engagements at the Intersectorial Forum on Agrobiodiversity and Agroecology in Kenya. She explains the benefits of embracing the bioeconomy.
We can continue growing our economy, contributing to our GDP, contributing to job creation, because these industries that are manufacturing industries that manufacture such produce that we get or products that we get from agriculture, they minimize the emission of greenhouse gases. And this means that we will have cleaner environment, and then it means that even the jobs will be retained and more will be created, and it means that even there will be sustainable food production.
The East African Community Regional Bloc has developed a bioeconomy strategy that aims to have sustainable industrialization, improve food and nutrition security, improve health, and create bio-based products which are derived from plants, animals and microorganisms. Tenkwano says ISIPE is trying to show the way.
We develop and deploy nature-positive solutions for insect pest and vector management. We also lead research in insects as alternative sources of protein for food and feed and agents of organic waste conversion.
Experts say the bioeconomy as a principle is winning supporters. However, a lack of financing, poor infrastructure, low agricultural productivity, and excessive government regulation still present challenges to broader adoption. Mohammed Yusuf, VOA News, Nairobi.
Nigeria's oil sector could be heading towards stability as no agreements among the Nigerian National Petroleum Company Limited, NNPC, Dangote Refinery, and independent oil marketers may end long-standing issues over fuel imports. NNPC and oil marketers will now take petrol directly from local refiner Dangote instead of importing it, aiming to reduce import costs, stabilize prices, and make fuel more affordable for consumers. Gibson Emeka reports from Abuja.
Community health worker John Maro says he used to rely on a flashlight when working night at the Sabongida Primary Health Center in Nigeria's Nasarawa State. But that was before a solar grid arrived in his community.
And if there's any case that come in the night, we suffer it, we use this torchlight in order to treat our cases. And for labor cases, it was. We use torchlight. It's not easy.
In Sabongida, a farming community an hour from the state capital of Lafia, community leader Dauda Yakubu says the new solar power grid is making his life easier. He says there has been progress and development in welding, pumping fuel at filling stations, grinding, water purification and refrigeration. Entrepreneur Suleiman Dauda says the community is enjoying the added ease and other benefits of the solar grid. He says they didn't have light before the solar was installed. They used a generator, which was challenging. The first interconnected solar power grid was installed in collaboration with PowerGen, a renewable energy company in Africa that aims to close electricity gaps in rural areas. Omobolanle Atobatele, the head of stakeholder engagement at Husk Power Systems, says in many cases the solar companies can work with more traditional energy companies to keep the lights on.
The regulation also allows us to go into areas where the distribution companies have their franchise area, but they are presently underserving them with electricity with less than 8 hours. And so we can partner with them to provide mini grids to buffer off the supply they're presently giving, so that at least you can have minimum 20 to 23 hours.
It's a great start, but a big job lies ahead. According to the World Bank, about 45% of Nigeria's population lack access to the electricity grid. For Gibson Emeka in Abuja, Nigeria, Grace Oyenubi, VOA News.
As the world awaits United States President-elect Donald Trump's return to the White House next month, Taiwan is caught between growing Chinese aggression and uncertainties surrounding U.S.-Taiwan relations. VOA's William Young reports from Taipei.
From military personnel to civilians, Taiwan's residents have been preparing for an uncertain future with the new U.S. president soon to take office and mounting pressures from China. Beijing considers self-governed Taiwan a part of China and says it will use force, if necessary, to make that claim a reality. While President Joe Biden has repeatedly said the U.S. will come to Taiwan's aid if China were to attack, President-elect Trump has suggested Taiwan should pay the U.S. for its defense.
稍微吧，因为川普他。
28-year-old Taipei resident Angel Chi says she's worried because it's hard to tell what Trump is saying and what he is actually doing behind the scenes. She says Trump has always acted in his own interest and that of the U.S.
Together with Donald Trump,
while Trump has picked prominent China hardliner Marco Rubio and Michael Waltz as potential cabinet nominees, his comments on Taiwan have been vague. Here's Trump's response in July 2023 in an interview with Fox News.
I don't want to say what I'm thinking. You know, I just, if I answer that question, it'll put me in a very bad negotiating position.
Michael Cole is a geopolitical analyst based in Taipei.
We don't know at this point if he means it when he wants to return United States to a more isolationist position.
China's position is clear from this November 7th press conference from its foreign ministry spokesperson Mao Ning.
China firmly opposes any form of official interaction between the United States and Taiwan.
Some Taiwan residents think the Democratic Islands values will help cement relations with the U.S. and like-minded countries. 55-year-old Chen Zhenyi says Trump wants to differentiate himself from Biden, so he has his personal views. But Chen doesn't think that will affect Taiwan's value to the U.S. and internationally.
Trump wants to differentiate himself from Biden, so he has his personal views, but I don't think that will affect Taiwan's value in the U.S. or as part of the global line of defense.
Experts also agree major changes in U.S.-Taiwan relations under the next administration are unlikely. Lai Yizhong is president of the Prospect Foundation, a Taiwan-based think tank made up of academics and government officials.
The mood is that we will be very careful and very watchful about the development, but we are not panicking. We also have a very strong bipartisan support in the Congress, and that always can be Taiwan's best ambassadors to sustaining and improving the Taiwan-U.S. relations and in all different fields.
While Taiwan continues to court the U.S. and prepare for the incoming Trump administration, China has been ramping up military pressure toward the island since Taiwan President Lai Ching-te took office in May, with exercises around Taiwan and Coast Guard incursions. The actions are as much directed at Taiwan's government as its voters, says Ko.
They're hoping that by creating this sense of embattlement and containment of Taiwan, that inevitably, eventually, that would compel Taiwanese voters, if not Taiwanese government, to engage in risk avoidance.
Ko says Beijing's level of aggression toward Taiwan may depend on its assessment of the new Trump administration's policies for Taiwan and China. William Yang, VOA News, Taipei, Taiwan.
And now for all our listeners preparing for the holiday season and the new year, we have a greeting from Accra, Ghana, brought to us by journalist James Shimonyula. Here is Mercy Matikwa.
I would love to wish Voice of America a very, very Merry Christmas and a prosperous 2025. For me, Voice of America means a lot. Having that I live in Africa, I usually listen to Voice of America English to Africa service. And we are so proud to know that we can get a lot of information on radio, social media, the web, television. And they have very nice programs. And me as an audience, I get a lot of information, politics, sports, music, health, business, entertainment, science, and all that. Voice of America, to me, it is like a second home. So once again, I pray Merry Christmas and a prosperous 2025. I am so happy to know that I'm still going to choose Voice of America come 2025.
For all our listeners, we at VOA wish you a peaceful, prosperous 2025. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. On behalf of our producer, David Van Dee, and our engineer, Cedric Franklin, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.